This is from all of the students.
Oh, thank you.
We're so grateful.
Thank you. As a representative, beautiful, thank you. So, anyway, part of the bhakti process, we try to please, and we try to please Krishna, and those that represent Krishna, and those that represent Krishna is anyone who represents Krishna. It's not just a teacher or a guru, it's a friend who represents Krishna. It's a parent who represents Krishna. It's a manager who represents Krishna. As long as they represent Krishna and they're connected to principles of eternal truth that are not determined by their own whims or particular moods. Good. Thank you. Wonderful. I needed some aromatherapy today. I did. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam yena bhutale Svayam rupa kedamayam Dadati sapadantikam Vansha kalpa tarubhyasya Kripa sindhu cha Patitanam pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasade Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama, Rama, Hare, Hare. So happy to see all of you again. To again exchange in bhakti. There are six principles of bhakti in your practices in the world, which is from the next book we'll study next year, which is called Upadeshamrita. And it's one of the verses is very beautiful. It says, Dadati Pritagrinati, you give gifts, you accept gifts. Guyam Ayachi Prichati, you explain in confidence. You learn in confidence. And bhunte bhojyate chaiva. You give prasad and you accept prasad. So it's so nice on the last day we're just living bhakti after studying bhakti. Very wonderful. And I'll give you a little coming attractions for today's class. We covered the Eastern Division. And now we have to cover the Southern Division in five waves, and the Western Division in five waves, and the Northern Division in nine waves. But what I'm going to do is, it's all based on a theory, and it's a very beautiful theory about how love of God reaches the highest point. So that, see, the concept of God is, Prabhupada said that he had a German God brother and he was looking in India, who is God? And he was searching so many deities and so many different forms. And they have, you know, different people with pitchforks and snakes and so many things. And then he saw the threefold bending form of Krishna. He's very intelligent, this guy. He said, that must be God, he said, because God must be enjoying. And what is enjoying? Enjoying means love. So God is the enjoyer of love. But the beauty of that concept is that those who participate in that enjoy more than God enjoys. Because love is an energy. It's actually ultimately an energy of God. And to give it, you actually relish it more than even receiving it. So God has a very unfortunate position. Because he is the object of love, but the devotees are the subject of love. And the simple example is just of a mother. The mother is sacrificing and doing everything for the child. And the child's experiencing, in a functional society, in an ideal society, the child is receiving so much motherly love. But the same energy is experienced by the mother, but from a different perspective. She's the subject of the love. The child is the object of the love. But the subject of the love, the abode of the love, the reservoir of the love, enjoys more than the object of the love. And therefore, in Krishna theology, and I'm going to try to keep this group together, you know, continue somehow once a month, maybe next year in the spring, I'll give 4 or 5 classes on some book and then continue once a month. The concept of Chaitanya is that for God to be complete in his enjoyment of love, he has to take the position of his devotee. Otherwise, God is not complete as the supreme enjoyer. So perfect love is called rasa. It's when the feelings of love are heightened to the highest degree by different emotional experiences that happen in the activities of the divine, which is called lila. And I just want to explain that theory in this class and show you how the nectar of devotion is structured. And if you really want to read about it further, you could actually read The Waves of Devotion. I summarize it and explain it. You can go over that with the nectar of devotion. So that's basically my idea. And then what I want to do is after the break, some of you have seen it, but we're going to have this drama. But the nature of spiritual drama is it's an experience, it's a communication of love of God. So it's not that you get bored of it. The only thing you never get bored of is love. Because love has no objective. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, when it describes bhakti, it says sasukam, kartam avyam. It's joyfully performed. Why? Because if you're on the path of yoga, as not as an exercise or a support or for meditation, but as your path, really, as an ascetic path, which is based on jnana, extreme intellectual, analytical discrimination. If you're on that path, the path is not fun. The goal is what you want. The goal is the moksha, the liberation. And then in liberation, you're not still churning the things and knocking your material desires with the terminator samskara, the last thought in your mind, which hates any other thoughts. You're in some kind of sublime state. That's the goal, not the activity. And same thing, karma. So many rituals, you get so bored and tired. At least I do. Swaha, swaha, swaha. The sages of Namasharanya, they got so bored. They were doing this sacrifice for the benefit of humanity. And then they said, Vayam natu vitriptyatma uttama shloka vartate. Yatrinvatam rasagyana swadu swadu. Vayam natu. We never get tired. Uttama shloka vartate. Of discussing lila, pastimes, rasa of God and his devotees. Yatrinvatam, when we hear rasagyanam, this taste of love. Swadu, swadu, pade, pade. Again and again we can enjoy. You know what swadu means? It's one of the four types of eating. You can chew, swallow, lick, and suck. So swadu is, just imagine, thick, creamy, sweet rice. And swadu, swadu, again and again and again you relish. They're saying that because they were getting tired of the smoke in their face. They were doing all the rituals. So karma takes money and rituals and setting it up. But there's a goal, which is like the heavenly plan. But in bhakti, there is no goal. Because if you're doing bhakti for any other reason but to please the person, which is what you're doing now, it's no longer bhakti. So bhakti is the ultimate pleasure, and God is rasika. Rasika means a connoisseur of love. So what this is, the later sections of the Nectar of Devotion, or what they're going to describe is how this love is composed. Both in the ultimate reality, how it's recreated in drama and poetry. And it's very, very beautiful theory. And we're going to discuss a little bit about it. And what I'd like to do from here on in, and what I plan to do, if any of you would like to also come, we're going to have continue once a month. There'll be a date, I think we said, in July. What I'd like to do then is start to speak on Krishna's pastimes and relish them. Because they're so beautiful. The stories open your heart, and then there's so many beautiful philosophical points that can enter. This Tuesday, if anybody's here, I'm going to continue the same series I have on that story, Brahma Vimohan Leela. A lot of people that are coming are relishing it. But actually describe really what's happening. And really see what's happening, how that love is formed and composed. And we'll do that a little bit today in this original drama that I helped to write. I had someone, a very distinguished actor that I worked with on this originally. He came to India for 3 weeks. And I had a stack of my books on that particular pastime. You know how you have these dramas and through the years, different people play the lead role. You know, like I remember we watched The Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, and then it was Charles Laughton, and then a later thing, then someone else, and then someone else. There's, right? A different thing. So Megan now plays the part of the cowherd boy. First it was Alex. Then it was Ladini. Then it was Jai Giridhari. Then it was Ladini Radha. And now, starring Megan Sloan.
Which Alex?
What?
Which Alex? There are like five.
What?
Which Alex?
His name was Alex. It's another Alex. He was British. So grew up in America. So you got that. When you, in America, when you have a British accent, you go up one class. And if you go bowling, you go down one class. Sorry, I've studied these things. But wow, this is an intoxicating day if I've ever seen one. Okay, so that will be our plan. And somehow I couldn't get my notes printed out. So we'll begin to just like summarize a little bit about what we have studied, this beautiful garland. Wow. Okay? So we're going to give a summary of the whole Nectar devotion. Now, do you remember that Rupa Goswami was a poet? He was an individualist. So he didn't just want to write chapters of a book. Right? Think Madan Mohan. Doesn't, you know, wants to do things a little differently, right? Poets are like that. So what he did is he divided the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu like an ocean, which is, has four divisions, right? So there was an eastern division, which described varieties of devotional service. Actually, go to the next slide, this one, and then we'll go back. Describe varieties of devotional service. And then, I made a mistake. It should have been the eastern division. We'll correct that before we put it up. Then the southern division, we're going to go over that a little bit today, Samanya Bhakti. It's Samanya means general symptoms of bhakti. What this means is for that perfect love to happen, there are different ingredients. And there's five ingredients of five different types of emotional experiences. It's interesting. I'll explain it. When they combine together, they bring the love to this intensely overwhelming feeling of bhakti, totally consuming feeling of bhakti called rasa. So this has five waves, and it'll describe the five components. The example was given of a connoisseur. Anybody ever try to cook for a connoisseur? Well, it happens to be the birthday celebration of a famous connoisseur today. And if you come tomorrow for Giriraj Swami's class in the Bhagavatam, he's going to speak about him. It's actually Kastupa Prabhu's guru and a great friend of mine named Tamal Krishnamurti, who's called the Gourmet Guru. And he was so particular. I'll just give you one example. He was so particular. There's an Indian preparation called dokla. It's kind of like a baked, like with dal cake. And his cook, as it would come out of the oven onto his plate, his finger would go down on the grain and test the grain. And if it wasn't proper, he would call his cook. And he was from New York, so it sounded something like this. His cook's name was Gopuraj. Gopuraj! And then his cook would respond, "Yes, Guru Dev." And then he said, "This is, you know, overcooked or something." And then the cook would confide to me, he's a good friend, he said, "It's impossible." You know? See, what he had to do is he had to take it out of the oven 10 seconds before it was cooked. So basically, it almost can cook in the air. And on the, he was a connoisseur. Well, that's a little extreme, but the example that Jiva Goswami gives, and I'm really going to try my hardest in the next 35, 40 minutes to explain this whole theory. And if not, I'll continue in July. But he gave the example of cooking sweet rice. Now, when you cook sweet rice, if you give it to a cultured person, it's nothing wrong being a connoisseur. A person who likes things in the proper way. So if you give it to a connoisseur, the milk cannot be cooked too much, can't be pasty, it can't be too watery. The rice can't be cooked too much, you know, a little mushy or too little. The sugar can't be too much, right, or too little. And I forgot there were some other things. So if you give to a cultured person, you know, and it's just rice paste, or it's just, you know, rice floating in water, you know, they won't appreciate it. But a person that's not cultured, they don't just care if it's milk and sugar. Right? Wow, great prep, Prabhu. You know, and it's just milk and sugar. You know, and they threw the rice in. The guy's ecstatic. But, you know, a connoisseur is, everything has to be right. So what this theory says is that God is a connoisseur of love. And there are different ingredients that make that love, which God enjoys. The perfect love on the ultimate platform. And that is the stories of Krishna. And and literature that perfectly reflects that is called Rasa Shastra. It's perfectly composed to communicate that. And the same thing, a cultured person, when he hears that type of literature that's composed in the proper way, those sentiments will be invoked in his heart that it's expressed, which is love of Godhead. And if it's not composed properly, if the ingredients are wrong, it's called rasabhas. You don't really get the same taste. And any cultured person will be like that. If you think, if you go to a drama, some people, if people get up there and they're slapstick and they're loud and everybody's roaring in the audience, but a cultured person who knows drama, he won't get that appreciation. The people that are roaring are not really getting the greatest appreciation either. It's just some kind of fun. It's not real aesthetics. But a cultured person, it won't have taste. And it's like anything we do, right? If you have an expertise in something, you know the composition that really invokes those sentiments and aesthetic sentiments. So this is going to have the five different components that make perfect love. And then the third division, this is the Western division, what it'll say is there's five types of relationships with Krishna. You can have an appreciation that's called neutrality. You can have a mood of servitorship, friendship, parental love, or conjugal sentiments. And what Rupa Goswami will show is what are the different, these five ingredients, how each of those relationships are composed, and what ingredients. I'll explain it a little bit more. And the northern division is indirect loving relationships. I'm not going to explain it. Let's go back to the beginning now. Okay, so we're going good. Now again, this is the Eastern Division. We just finished this, the Eastern Division. Right? The Eastern Division had four waves. And we actually had a fairly comprehensive study. And that's the main philosophical basis of the text, which in ISKCON and whatever their course is, this is what they expect you to know. And remember, we had Samanya Bhakti, an overview of devotional service. And basically, it described, remember we had a definition of devotional service and what are the general characteristics? There were six characteristics. That was chapter 1 and 2. Then chapters 2 to 16, Sadhana Bhakti, devotional service and practice. Remember, and some of the subjects we discussed, what is sadhana? What is the practice of devotional service? Practice has a goal. What is the goal of devotional service? It's bhava. It's mature, deep sentiments of love. Real love. a love that is actually your desire to serve mixed with God's bliss potency of love that enters into your heart. That's the goal. So what is sadhana bhakti? Sadhana bhakti is when you use your senses, your mind, your words, and your actions to get that. There's a practice. How do you get that? Well, you have to use your mind, your body, and your words to focus on transcendence, to focus on Krishna. And when you focus on Krishna, when you focus on God, because we have a natural relationship with God, then that brings out these natural sentiments in the heart, which is called bhakti. So remember, and then we discussed who is eligible for this. So many different subjects. I'm not going to go it over again. This is just to encourage you to read it over again and learn it in context. And then, remember, we just finished. There were 64 practices, right, of how you do it. And remember the beginning practices, right? It first begins with by taking shelter of the will of God, which is represented by someone who loves God and therefore has whose only life is to please the absolute reality, Krishna, and therefore his heart represents the will and desires of the Supreme, and then taking shelter of that, right? And then making a commitment in that relationship, taking instructions. And then there were so many regulations, regulations, what you avoid. You avoid committing offenses. You avoid giving pain to other living entities and things that you do. Sadpritya Dharma, you inquire about devotional service. So many things. And then so many devotional practices. And then at the end, there were five that were prominent. And they were so powerful, these five practices, that even someone who's a neophyte, he doesn't have much affection in his heart. If he does them in a humble, simple way, that goal of bhava can enter into his heart. Who can remember the five most potent items of devotional service? Or one of them? What? Hearing Srimad Bhagavatam? What? Mathura Vas, residing in a holy place, yes?
Associating with devotees.
Serving the devotees.
Chanting
the holy name.
Eating prasad.
What?
Sacred food.
That's part of one of the items, but that's a specific one of a more general one, but that's good. Come on.
Worshipping
the deity. And part of that is taking the sacred prasadam. Those five items. If you come with a simple heart before Radha Muralidhar, if you chant the holy name with a simple heart, if you serve the devotees and you hear from them with a simple heart, if you visit the holy places, And places of Krishna's pastimes with a simple heart. And if you hear, like we're doing now, then we can get bhava. I'm going to go back one, I think. I'm trying to memorize my notes because I don't have them. Back one? Yes. And this verse described how the whole process works. First begins with Shraddha. And Shraddha is faith. And what is this faith? It's your trust that my ultimate happiness will be bhakti. My ultimate happiness will be the consciousness in the heart of wanting to please Krishna, which is inclusive of everything. The best definition of bhakti I ever heard was, bhakti is best expressed in seva, which means loving responsiveness to God, to the Lord, through the faculties of the mind, the body, and the words. See, it's not just the love and it's not just the action. It's the love in action is bhakti. But that feeling in the heart. And as bhakti yogis, when we finally still the mind of all the selfish desires, all the anxieties and fears based on the desire to be the center of the universe and conform the world to all my desires, we all have it. We can't even expect to transcend it. We can just dedicate ourselves. But when we actually become perfect and we're living in that feeling of gratitude, that feeling of compassion, that feeling of humility, that feeling of that desire to serve, when we're living in that, that feeling in the heart is the highest ecstasy. Even though that feeling does not want anything for oneself. So when that a drop of that comes into your heart and a taste of that comes into your heart, that's called shraddha, faith. And somehow other, everyone here, to one degree or another, has that faith. And then when that faith grows, then sadhu sangha, then you want to be with the people who have that feeling in their heart and live their life in that way. And that more and more becomes your community. And then bhajana kriya, then you begin to adopt, according to your own capacity, practices that move you towards your goal of filling your heart with pure, unalloyed love. And then anartha nivritti, artha, anartha, that, those things which don't have value to your goal of getting that sublimity, right? So, you know, just think sometimes someone's an alcoholic, but they kind of know that that activity has no value to their ultimate goal, even whatever their goal is, of a decent family and a happy life. So we have things that we know don't have any value. And Vishyavini Vartante Niraharasya Dayana Raso Rajam Raso Pyasya Param. And by that higher taste of Krishna consciousness, that higher taste of kirtan and love and service and devotion, then gradually those things that don't have value to our objective are. And then nishta. Then at a particular time, as it's a gradual process, years, lifetimes, 1 year, immediately. Everybody has a different spiritual evolution. Nishta, we become fixed. We're always on that platform and thinking, what pleases Krishna? And it doesn't mean renunciation. You know, you're a mother, right? And you know... you want to sit in the Bhagavatam class. No, what pleases Krishna is your kid is running over there in the street. You're supposed to be watching your kid. But you have no selfishness left in your heart. You're fixed. And you're fixed in practices to cultivate this goal of life. And then ruchi, when that happens, we get a legitimate taste for Krishna consciousness. So much so that whenever the mind goes or whatever we do that's away from it, immediately we pull it back. because that's our attraction. And then we didn't put the second half of the verse. Then there's a stage called Ashakti. And Ashakti means you have an addiction, a voice in your heart. This is a real advanced sage. You have a voice in your heart that is addicted. It's compelling. It's not even intellectually that you have to pull the mind back. Your mind is just, it's just like, you know, again, someone has an addiction. It's not like they say, oh, now I should take a drink. That nature is just pulling them. So your nature of bhakti is just pulling you. And the voice in your heart to serve becomes so all-consuming that you attract by that desire to serve God's potency of love enters into your heart. And that's called bhava. Let's go now to the... That's called bhava. Structure. No, back to the first. That's called bhava. 17th and 18th chapter, we describe that. What happens? The heart just melts, right? Bhava means emotion. The heart just melts. I remember this sadhu. He was kind of a friend of mine, almost like a little bit of a guru figure. And he was working really, really hard. And he was doing work in one institution. It wasn't ISKCON. It was one institution in India, but it was a Vaishnav institution. And then somehow he got a break and he went to Govardhan Hill, which is a very sacred spiritual place. And he was telling me every time he would chant the holy name, he would cry. Every time he would see a saintly person, he would cry. Every time he would read the Bhagavatam, he would cry. Right, Lisa, when we get to Vrindavan, we can, some little drop comes. Saibel, right? Remember when I never forget when we almost lost you. There was a group of old Indian ladies dancing in ecstasy past the MBT, and Saibel, wait. Morgan and Stanley, your husband, your house in Pennsylvania. Not yet. Right? But there's a sweetness. So, and bhava, and you just have such a strong desire. I want to be with God. I want to be with Krishna. I want to serve Krishna. I want to have an intimate relationship with Krishna. So that's called bhava. And then we described last time there really nine symptoms, because these things can be, the emotions can be imitated, but there are nine symptoms. Like avyakta, always engaged, being prideless, even though you have reason to be praised, you're so humble. Detachment, you're so aloof from everything, you're attached to the holy name. All these things, I don't have to explain them. If people that are interested more, even after this course, you could read a chapter a week, or maybe just read the Waves of Devotion over again and get a whole summary of this. And then prema bhakti, the goal of life. Bhava is this love, and look at the sun rays, and look at prema as the sun. It's condensed. It's so condensed. And this is the perfection of life. This is ultimately, in our conception of philosophy, what we want. We want to be consumed with love. What other goal can there be? Everyone has to admit that. What other goal can there be to be just consumed with love? And not all these other things that I do these japa meditation classes, and I have my own method of meditating. Also, when I was down in South America, I gave two seminars. Sweet, nice people came, and you know, and I get people focused. How to focus on the holy name in different ways from my years of experience of doing so. And you get them very, very much focused. And my last meditation is, feel the gratitude in your heart. Because you really got something from this. Feel the gratitude in your heart. Now live in that. Live in that gratitude. And live in that gratitude, which is expressing a desire to serve others. To serve God, to serve others. Live in that. And distinguish that, because that's the real self. That what's happening now is you're having symptoms of your real self. So live in that peacefully. And for 1 minute, I say, just live in that. And distinguish that from where you usually live. Right? Which is the false ego and the mind. Me, anxieties, fears, this, that. So there's a goal to come and actually live in that soul intensely. So anyway, we discussed all that. Next thing. And then that was the last verse. And now the divisions of it. And this is the southern division. So I think this is very, very important to understand. These are the five ingredients that bring what's called rati, or a desire, a love of Krishna, to rasa, or the height. Now, this concept of rasa, it's used in drama. And what really means is to be consumed by emotion. And really, it's used in drama when the audience becomes consumed by the emotion that the drama is expressing. And it should be an all-consuming feeling. So I'm going to do something that I normally don't do, is that drink during the class, because I'm, after 45 years of speaking, I'm beginning to realize that I get so excited when I'm teaching, especially subjects like this, that the fire of my enthusiasm dries up every last ounce of water in my body. And then I go on, and then I become... Okay. Well, you know, if I don't finish everything, I'm just going to continue every month. And if you want to come, we can learn more. So, these are five... And these are Prabhupada's terms. So, these are the five components of perfected love. And each relationship with Krishna is composed of these five things, these five emotional experiences. They're composed of these five emotional experiences, but unique to their relationship. Now, let's see if I can explain this in a way. So now I'm going to take what's called Vatsalya Ras, motherly love, Mother Yasoda's love for Krishna, right? So I'm going to start with the fifth wave. This agreement means Stai Bhav. There has to be a permanent feeling of love. So each relationship with Krishna has a different permanent feeling of love, right? Like a parent's feeling of love, Vatsalya Ras, their feeling, because these things can change. If you look at like an ocean, there's the seawater and there's waves and there's salt and but the ocean stays the same. So this is the feeling of love, and each relationship has a particular feeling of love, and they're different. For example, a servant's feeling of love, his permanent feeling, when he approaches a superior is, look at a child with a loving father. What is the child's love? You are my protector. And what's his love to the mother? You are my maintainer. That's the feeling of love. But what's the feeling of love of a parent to a child? Let's say a servant of Krishna is looking at Krishna and saying, you are my maintainer. You are my protector. Without you, I will die. But what's the parent's mood of love? I am your maintainer. I am your protector. Without me, you will die. So they have a different sthayi bhav, a different core love. The love of a mother is called anugraha or mercy. That's why a mother will never see the child as anything but a child, even when they get older, because it ruins their love. Their love is, I am your maintainer. I always give the example, I go visit my mother, and then, you know, I'm walking out of the house, and she says, put on your hat. I say, I don't need to put on a hat. She says, put on a hat. Right? You're going to get sick. I say, look, I don't need a hat. You know, I don't need a hat. Right? And I feel like saying, Mom, I'm the guru. You know? And I know what she'd say. You may be the guru, but you're my child. And they have the example of Krishna. He eats some dirt, and his mother looks in the mouth of Krishna. And when she looks in the mouth of Krishna, she sees herself. She sees Krishna. She sees all the universes. She sees everything that's outside of her. And what happens? She becomes stunned. And it ruins her motherly love. Because motherly love is mercy, which requires an object of mercy. God is not an object of mercy. So what does she do? She prays, please, please, let me again see you as my child. And let me again see you, you know, and you be my son. So it's a feeling of love. It's a different flavor of love. Krishna is enjoying love, so he's enjoying different flavors. So he enjoys the love of his mother. And therefore, as the object of that love, he appears as a child. Because that's the object of motherly love. That someone is a child. So, you see, they're different. And friendship is the mood of equality. Parental, I'm superior. Child, you're superior. Friendship is something of equals. I always remember this story. I had my parents, they had a nice house in Brooklyn. We even had 50 by 100 square feet. And we had three bedrooms upstairs, and you would walk down the stairs and you'd come to kind of like a living room. And my father would be sitting on his father's chair that most fathers have. And I was a little bit naughty. So I had that nature, but I walked down the stairs and my father was sitting there. And I say, how you doing, Wally? His name was Walter. I told you that. Worshipful Walter Winnicker, Master Mason, the whole thing. Formal. My father was very formal. And he would look at me and say, I am not your friend. I am your father. And I'd say, okay, Wally. But it's a different sthayi bhav. It's a different feeling of love. So there's five different feelings of love. Okay? So that's one of the bhavas. I started with that. Now, vibhav, we're going to explain that more, but every relationship with Krishna requires Krishna as an object of the love and a devotee as a subject of the love. So let's say the relationship is parental, right? Then you need the object of the love is Krishna as a baby. And the subject of the love are his mothers, his fathers, his aunts, the nurses, right? So, but in friendship, then Krishna would be, you know, a different age, and he would have, it would be his different friends, and there would be different types of friends. And then in conjugal love, then Krishna would have to be between 12 and 15. And who are the devotees? They would be the gopis. So you see, so each relationship has a permanent feeling, and for it, for that feeling to be to mature, it also needs this vibhav. It needs Krishna as the object of love in that particular relationship, and it needs a particular devotee who has that love. And then anubhav. Anubhav means actions in love. Once you have the love in the heart, then there's a then it has to be expressed. So with Krishna and the gopis, the actions in love may be sidelong glances or embracing. And for the mother, there would be different actions in love. The mother would pat the child on the head and bless the child. She would offer her breast and give the child milk. They would give blessings. See, blessings actually come from a superior. So technically speaking, if you write a superior, you don't say blessings. Because blessings, this is in the culture thing, blessings come from a superior. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. It's not the relationship with a teacher, right, is servitude, right? So the actions are what? You fold your hands, you pay your obeisances, you wait for instructions. But if your relationship is, I am the teacher, then it's different. Like, you know, like for a child, you can pat on the head. That's an action of a parent. They give blessings, right? A little thing on the head. Nice. Right? But if you're the student, right, and you go, Jai Gurudev, you see, it's a different action. Right? They're different. This is actually the philosophy of culture, actually, and how love even develops. One of the worst things about America is there's no more age appropriateness. Every 12-year-old girl wants to be 20, and every 70-year-old lady wants to be 20. But it used to be so beautiful, right? People would age. And then they would actually be able to give affection. And people would be able to offer respect. And love would be nourished in the society. I had one student, and he was like a heavy, hardcore, rock star, superstar, you know, jumping with the guitar, heavy, revolutionary. And then he became a devotee, and he was staying in Vrindavan with me, and I had two rooms and with a door, and all of a sudden at night about 8 o'clock, I hear a knock on the door, and I open the door and he's on his knees, and he says, Guru Maharaj, can I take rest now? I looked at him like, that's so not you. And he said, You know, I'm realizing about Krishna consciousness. I want to experience the different types of love. I want to actually feel affection and offer respect. Right? Like friends will hug. Right? And of course, the teacher could also hug affectionately. So you see, there's different actions in every relationship that are appropriate for the relationship. And the different people that have those relationships. This is sattvic bhav. It's involuntary ecstatic expressions. And it's a really incredible science about this. I don't know. I mean, I could go in detail, but when I read and studied, it's so interesting that what happens in very advanced stages of devotion, that one will be so focused in a particular way in devotion that that emotion will so much vibrate his mind that the mind would kind of affect the life airs in a particular way, and then the life airs would somehow contact what's called tan mantra, the basic material elements, and if they would contact the water element, then like water would just pour out of a person's eyes like the Ganga. Or the air element, the hairs would stand on end. There was a god sifter of mine who Prabhupada said had bhava, had ecstatic feelings. And she told me stories of actually when her hairs were standing on end in relationship to seeing her guru do different things. Or trembling. I'm really conscious of time, so I know I can't go in. It's just so interesting. And Vyabhachari Bhavs, they're these emotions that come from this ocean of love. So let's say you're the mother, right? You have that motherly love, and your child is in danger. Then what happens? Fear, right? But what does that fear do? It increases the love. Oh, my child, the love increases. And then what happens is, or jubilation, right? Someone sees their lover and they're very beautiful, then the jubilation comes. Or sometimes the anxiety. So there's 33 of these emotions. And it's such an interesting theory, and I'm just preventing myself from going too deep, but it's so technically beautiful, actually. It's so scientific, how one emotion comes, and then another emotion comes, and another one, and then contradictory ones, and you get this idea of churning. So if you get an idea, Vibhav, there's the basic, this is called the basic thing. Let's say motherly love. Okay, vatsalyas, anugraha, mercy. That's the permanent ecstasy, right? So the basic thing that will cause it is what? To come up. Is you need Krishna as a baby and their mothers. And then there's another thing here, which is called udipan, and something to excite it. The child smiles, right? He babbles something cute. He begins to walk, right? Then what happens is, there's actions of love. The mother just grabs, Mother Yasoda grabs Krishna's, starts smelling his head. You know, just touching him like that. Then she becomes overwhelmed with ecstasy and she starts feeding him breast milk. So there's actions in love. These are, they're not just actions. If your teacher comes and you pay obeisances, it's not just a physical action, it's an emotional experience. And then what will happen? And then Krishna will be in danger. And what happened to Mother Yasoda? We'll see today in the drama. Krishna's in a deadly serpent in the river. And Mother Yasoda will want to save Krishna and run into this poisonous water and her friends will stop her. And Mother Yasoda will faint. Sattvic bhav. Right? Involuntary things will happen. And then Vyabhachari bhav. There'll be anxiety, there'll be fear, there'll be jubilation. Krishna's saved, now there's jubilation. There'll be all these emotions. So what they're saying is all this will just churn together to bring love to the highest platform. And what Rupa Goswami said, this is a very interesting thing. I'm going to go 10 more minutes, then we're going to take a break. And then we're going to have the drama. And then I'll explain the drama a little bit afterwards. But so you'll see in the drama, you'll be able to identify all these. And what Rupa Goswami, and this is a very, very important point, I'm going to explain it very, very briefly. More than 1,500 years ago, maybe 2,000 years ago, there was a famous sage called Bharat Muni. And I believe some people consulted him, and they're saying, we're studying scriptures, and we're studying so many things, and people are not overcoming ego. So Bharat Muni said, we need something audible and visible. And then what he did is he channeled Lord Brahma, who's the chief engineer of the universe, and through that, almost like he channeled this scripture called Natya Shastra, which is a very technical thing about drama. And the basis of the theory is that in human experience, there are eight overwhelming emotions that consume you, which are the basis of any drama, like compassion, like anger, like romance, like chivalry, like horror. So he listed eight emotions that are completely consuming. And then he showed in drama, to the extent of scenic designs, introduction, very technical theory, how you can recreate those emotions in drama in such a way that people in the audience will feel the same thing. Now, they also had a spiritual theory about it. When it is composed properly and the audience feels that emotion, all, almost like a one mind of the audience, then they would interpret different ways how it would be a spiritual experience. I'll just explain basically. Basically, what would happen is you have this emotional experience, but you would be viewing it with sympathy, and it wouldn't be yours. So it wouldn't be connected to your limited eye. Right? It wouldn't be connected to your ego, but you would have this experience. And not only you have this experience, but you'd have this experience shared with everyone else as if you were one mind, and you'd rise above the limited I. And it was, and Greeks called it catharsis. Aristotle wrote about it, but this was predated him, really, really far. And I'm glad this happened before, because I get to go out in the break and stop it during our drama. So I got 5 more minutes before our break. So anyway, many, many people profess different theories how drama would elevate people above the limited I and would get them off that ego about me, everything coming from me. And some people just said it would point people towards a spiritual experience, etc. Comprehensive literature written at it. What happened is, and this is what I want to discuss today, Rupa Goswami, he was reading the Bhagavatam, which predates the Natya Shastra, and he saw that this very technical, complicated theory about how you can communicate emotions in drama, the Bhagavatam was perfectly composed. But what the Bhagavatam would be communicating is not ordinary experience, but spiritual experience. It would be communicating the ultimate reality, which was not the Karuna Ras, compassion, or the Vira Ras, chivalry, or the Sringa Ras, romance, but the Bhakti Ras, the feelings of intense love for God. And therefore, what Rupa Goswami concluded was, is that the Natya Shastra, because it comes after, then how can this come before? And his conclusion was, what the Natya Shastra is actually reflecting the ultimate reality, which is a drama. The ultimate reality is a drama of love of God. And therefore, the perfect relationships in this world are a reflection of it, and people who compose drama are a reflection of that. That there's actually, in the ultimate reality, when you want to become perfect in love, perfect in consciousness, then what that perfectness in consciousness is becoming consumed and overwhelmed with the rasa of perfect love of Godhead. And that's what Krishna Lila is. That's what the Bhagavatam is. And one of the ways that we advance on the path of bhakti is by hearing the Bhagavatam, which is a drama. Or hearing, and Rupa Goswami himself wrote comprehensive dramas and poetry. And by listening to these things in the proper mood, then the feelings of love that are composed in these dramas are actually, the audience feels it. And it's one of the practices of bhakti. So what Rupa Goswami does, go back, is this, all this is the theory of drama, the Southern, the Western, and it's the theory of drama. It's the whole Natya Shastra in complete analysis of the pastimes of Krishna, of how the pastimes of Krishna are perfectly composed in all these bhavas, in different relationships. So by studying this and reading this, then when you read the Krishna book and you read the stories of Krishna, it makes more sense. This is not just some story, but this is a reflection of the ultimate reality, which is, this is how I would say it, everyone here is looking for pleasure. If that's pleasure is love, if that's the guiding principle here, why shouldn't that be in the ultimate reality? And if it's there in the ultimate reality, if love is the ultimate reality, why shouldn't the ultimate reality have a concrete expression of love? And that's what Krishna's pastimes is. So after our break, and we'll take a 10-minute break, and you'll hear me enthusiastically saying Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, we will come back and we will have this drama. And after the drama, we'll have a little bit, 10 minutes, where we can show you how this is just perfectly composed. And just try to relish it. And maybe one day I'll do this drama, maybe on Janmashtami, where we can actually have, combine it with like bhajans that express the mood of love, and finish it with kirtan, which help create the rasa. Okay, that's basic. In July, I'll explain a little bit more about it. But I hope you got a basic idea. Okay? Let's take a break. Now, before the drama, I usually pray to my god sister, who passed away. She's a very, very close friend, and one of the kindest and coolest people I've ever met. Her name was Rasa Gya, and Prabhupada said she was the best actor, actress in ISKCON. And they used to have a drama group called the Vaikuntha Players. And in those days, everybody lived within the temple, so it was easy to practice. And they would go out on the streets and do these live dramas, and people were just like amazed. Like, you know, kind of reality type stuff. And if you see a video of the original Rath Yatra where Prabhupada comes, she's playing some kind of part in that. It's amazing. So I always pray to her. Very wonderful person. Great loss. Great loss. Okay. Krista, we were waiting for you. We do, because we can't have people coming in and out. So sit down. We'll begin the drama. No problem. We want the rasa. We want everyone in it together. When I was younger, and the world was younger, and our spirits were younger, I lived in the mystical land of Vrindavan, which I suppose was too is younger, though really it's an ageless place. This is a city of magnificent temples, sadhus and sages, rich and colorful history, saintly widows, monkeys. At the time, no cell phones or computers. But most important, it was the home of Krishna, his friends, his family, and his loved ones. I was charged with saving the ancient Vaishnav libraries, libraries filled with musty old books, all but forgotten tombs that contained deep and esoteric passages of spiritual history and wisdom. In one such library belonging to the late Pran Krishna Baba, it seemed that all the books were far too damaged by time or lack of proper care to be salvageable. I was prepared to abandon the collection, but then I saw one book lying on the floor apart from the rest. I immediately picked it up, knowing that regardless of its title or current condition, no such sacred book should lie on the floor. To my amazement, it was in near perfect condition. I turned the cover and glanced at the first page. Hari Lila Prakash, 17th century scribe by Sri Damodar Bahulanath. I've never heard of the author, but as I read on, I found his claims and insights remarkable. He claimed to be a 17th century descendant of one of Krishna's most intimate associates, Vasant. He claimed to be his great, that's Vasant's great, 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 great grandson, and so on. Hari Lila Prakash is a beautiful story of Krishna and Vasant in the beautiful surroundings of the Vrindavan forest. My friends, my hands were shaking. The hairs on my neck were standing on end. I realized I was holding a precious jewel. It was almost if the book wanted me to find it. Among the most fascinating aspects of Hari Lila Prakash is an excerpt found in the appendix entitled Sri Krishna Lila, A Reasonable Conception of Divinity. It seems like Damodar's lifelong concerns was that the pastimes of Krishna would be thought of as mythological or mundane, and thus the deep spiritual import would be lost. Listen to his ideas. I think you'll find them significant. All of us are seeking pleasure, and our greatest pleasure is found in pure, unmotivated love. If pure love is our guiding and universal principle, then why should it not be part of its source, the ultimate reality? As pure love entails a mutual exchange, then the one harmonious truth must have a type of discrimination within. There must be personality, beauty, and other qualities to enhance the flow of love. This flow of love is known as Shakti or energy, and like all energy, devoted to bringing pleasure to its source. Thus, the Vaishnav conception of reality is divine Leela, a drama that staged the perfect expression of love, an exchange of devotion between the source of all energies, Sri Krishna, and the supreme Shakti, Sri Radha. My friends, I felt like weeping. Such a deep concept, but explained in such simple and easily understandable terms. I now understood why the great Vaishnav teachers thus speak of rasa, the height of divine love, as that which one appreciates gradually belongs to one. By hearing these divine leelas, pastimes, the same pure divine love enters into one's heart. Sri Damodar continues, and just as love and pleasure to be appreciated to its fullest requires a variety of loving exchanges, why should not friendship, parental affection, and the love of secret and intimate dalliance why should it not exist in its pure sense in the divine realm? I should explain for those of you who don't know, Krishna is a beautiful cowherd boy that takes care of his father's cows. This job afforded him the opportunity to share his experiences with other boys that were occupied, to deeply befriend, actually, other boys that were occupied with the same task. They would gallivant all over the forest of Vrindavan, playing in the fields, resting in the trees, and sharing wonderful meals on the bank of the Jamuna River. But in Vrindavan, like any place else, there are just people that are opposed to even a smallest pinch of pure love. Demons. But if you think about it, aren't the challenges to love rise that affection to the highest degree? Did you ever fear the loss of a loved one? Wasn't it at that time that the sentiments of love reached its heights? That's why I'm so excited to share this with you. For Hari Lila Prakash tells the stories of the most pure and perfected love. I think we have time for just maybe one. One day, the waters of the Jamuna were visited by a multi-headed serpent named Kaliya. He was poisoning the water with the stench and fumes emanating from his hideous body, causing anyone drinking or even visiting to immediately die. But beautiful, oh beautiful Krishna would not stand for such a travesty, for the demon was threatening the home and livelihood, the welfare and livelihood of his friends, his home, and his well-wishers. Therefore, Krishna decided to take the matter into his own hands, and in doing so caused unimaginable anxiety for the residents of Vrindavan who love Krishna more than their very life. Imagine how they felt. No, don't imagine, just hear. It would not be proper for me to keep the insights of Sri Damodar Bahulanath to myself. Let's hear a first-person account by a witness that day to the beautiful feats of Krishna on the bank of the Jamuna. Listen carefully, for one who hears these divine leelas with attention and respect, the same love comes into their hearts. I'm going to read now. Damodar Bahulanath writes, upon returning home late one day from the forest, after Krishna's horrifying and then glorious struggle with the Kaliya serpent, I, Vasant, approach my worried mother with her arms crossed and a stick in her hand.
Mother! 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 I just seen the most amazing... Oh, yes, I know I'm late, but there's something... I know I made you worry, but it's not... Oh, okay, you're right, it's my fault, but there's something... No, I didn't do it on purpose. Mother! Mother! It's about Krishna! Yes, my friend Krishna was in trouble, and so were the rest of us. Well, my friends, that is. Well, then Krishna wasn't in trouble, and then neither were we. Promise you'll listen without punishing me, Mother? We were out in the fields taking care of the cows. While we walked, we were saying how glad we were that Krishna and Balaram had dealt with those nasty demons in the Taliban forest. Now all the delicious fruit were ripe to be picked, and the poor innocent animals no longer needed to be afraid, and we were so happy. What's that, Mother? Why am I late? Right. Well, with the warm sun shining so brightly, and after walking so far and working so hard, we became very thirsty. Krishna told us to follow him to the Yamuna, so we fell in step behind him, watching his feet leave perfect imprints in the dust and grass. When we reached the Yamuna, our throats were so parched that we drank and drank and... Well, what we hadn't noticed was... The water was... Well... Poisoned. I know, Mother, it sounds terrible, but I'm alive now! Not that I was dead before. At least I don't think so. I know, it sounds confusing, but all I know is after I drank the water, I began to feel very funny. The next thing I know, the other boys were clutching at their throats and falling to the ground. My head began to ache. My body felt very weak. I was gasping for air. I felt my life slipping away moment by moment. And just as my eyes closed for what I thought was the last time, I felt a warmth flowing through my body, filling my heart with love. I opened my eyes, and Mother, I was staring directly into Krishna's smiling face. The pain was nowhere to be found. All worry and fear had left me. I looked around. The other boys were no longer writhing on the ground. They looked as happy and surprised as me. We knew that somehow Krishna had saved us from the poisoned water. But better than not being dead, Mother, was waking to Krishna's smiling face greeting me. If only all moments of awakening were filled with such a happy sight. Always our protector, always our best friend. No, that's not the end of the story, Mother. It gets better. Do you want to hear the rest? You very much want me to continue? Oh, I'm so glad. Does this mean I'm not in trouble? I didn't think so. This next part is scary, Mother. We looked into the water to see if we could find what had made it so deadly. The most horrifying image. A giant, many-headed serpent swirled in the Yamuna, its skin as black as night, its eyes as red as flame, and clouds of poisonous nightmares spewing from its nostrils. I shook with fear, rooted to the spot. The lush grass around the Yamuna had become so foul, and it was turning brown and brittle, and the very life was being sucked out of the trees. I saw a bird flying overhead towards the banks of the Yamuna. I called out a warning, "Turn back!" But it was too late. As soon as it flew into the poisonous clouds, it fell down, dead. Tears welled up in my eyes. This beast was destroying Vrindavan, her beautiful home. I looked at my friends. Their faces said they felt the same as me. Except Krishna. He looked angrier than I have ever seen him. And so determined. I didn't know what he intended to do, but already his bravery was lessening my fear. I could see in his face he was thinking, "Serpent, how dare you poison these waters? How dare you harm the beauty of this spot, where so often I have rested with my friends in these soft grasses that you have turned to ash, enjoyed the sweet fragrances that you have laid to waste? How dare you harm the land and people of Vrindavan?" Krishna strode forward and climbed one of the dead kadamba trees. When he reached the top, he tightened the cloth of his belt, as if he was about to do something that required his full effort. Then he waved his arms like this. My friend Krishna looked so brave and powerful, I felt like cheering, Mother. Then Krishna jumped into the water. Oh, but I see other people have come to listen to my story, Mother. My words have attracted the saintly souls of Vrindavan. But these men and women, young and younger, they were all there at the Yamuna. They can say whether my story is true. Which reminds me, why are you not at the Yamuna, Mother? A calf was injured by a piece of rock falling from the sky. I know you were overcome with grief and worry, Mother, but taking care of the cows is one of our most important duties. I know why the rock fell, Mother. Yes, because it seemed Krishna was in great danger. When Krishna jumped into the water, he created a splash so large it was like a mighty tidal wave. We ducked away from the poisonous boiling water, and for a moment we couldn't see the Yamuna or anything in front of us until the water cascaded down across the surrounding land. But when we could see again, the Kadamba tree that Krishna had jumped from, the one I promised was dead, was now very much alive and blossoming with yellow flowers. Krishna swam in the water towards the many-headed serpent, slapping the water with his arms and calling out to the demon with such a mighty roar. I might have covered my ears from the deafening sound had it not reminded me of the most beautiful music coming from Krishna. So like the songs he would sing while strolling through the forest, accompanied by a symphony of birds. The serpent became enraged. But how could you be angry at Krishna? With such wondrous melodies filling the air, when his playing in the water made him glisten like a cloud in his yellow silken garments, when his sportive smile was a reflection of his pure heart. The serpent cared for none of this, and he struck at Krishna like lightning, biting him in the chest and wrapping him in his coils. I immediately called out in grief. I fell to my knees. The cows began to wail. The earth shook, and pieces of flaming rock fell from the sky. Could Krishna be dead? Oh, Krishna! Soon all the residents of Vrindavan gathered at the Yamuna, each demanding to know what had become of Krishna, but I was so shocked I couldn't speak. Mother Yashoda tried to run into the festering and boiling water, but the other women caught her, and in desperation she fainted in their arms. The only words that could comfort her were the triumphs of Krishna. I have never seen a more piteous sight, Mother. My heart breaks to think of her pain as she watched Krishna's limp body being crushed in the serpent's coils. Nanda Maharaj and the other men also tried to run into the water, but Balaram stopped them in their tracks. All around, the residents of Vrindavan were in fits of lamentation. I wish there was something I could do to save Krishna. I was hopeless. Then, as Balaram pushed the men back from the water, I noticed his face. And how strange, Mother. While the rest of us wept and called out to Krishna, he was smiling, as if he knew all would be well. The gopis' faces said they now saw the world as vacant without Krishna. Looks of despair so heavy, I never wish to see such pain again. And Balaram smiled. I'm not joking when I say I felt like my life was ending, Mother. Without my friend Krishna, I wouldn't want to be alive. Balaram smiled. Soon I saw why. For an eternity, I prayed for someone to save Krishna. Then, when all the residents of Vrindavan were present, Krishna freed himself from the serpent's coils. The great beast tried to bite him with his fangs as sharp as daggers, his flaming nostrils like cauldrons of boiling hatred. But Krishna began circling around, so agile, so swift. I saw the serpent begin to tire, and then, oh, wonder of wonders, in a single leap, Krishna jumped to the top of the serpent's hoods. I gasped in amazement, my breath caught in my throat. Krishna, the true artist that he is, began to dance on the serpent's heads. The rays of the sun shone through the jewels on the serpent's heads, making Krishna's feet appear glowing red as he ducked and span, leapt and twirled, his lotus feet moving so fast no one could ever hope to dance in such a way. Suddenly, the sound of music could be heard. The heavenly musicians, certainly pleased with the beauty of Krishna's dance, hoped to increase its wonder. I was awestruck, but it felt like watching a disturbed mind, saying it still had power, that it wasn't defeated, when Krishna's dancing feet had destroyed any hope of its survival. We could see from the shore that the beast was becoming exhausted, for from its mouths came blood and poison and even fire, but still the dance went on. Krishna's dancing feet would knock down each hood so fast it appeared the snake was bowing down before Krishna. And the pools of blood and poison began to appear like garlands of flowers being offered at Krishna's feet. The serpent's wives came forward, their garments and jewels all a mess as they rushed in their distress, praying to Krishna to please have mercy on their demon husband. Their prayers were so sad and heartfelt, Mother. I couldn't help but take pity on them. They begged that their demon husband must have had many lifetimes of piety if he now had Krishna's lotus feet upon his head. And I thought that the most beautiful prayer. Krishna stopped his dance. He ordered the serpent to leave at once and never again poison the waters of Yamuna, never again return or harm the animals, residents of Vrindavan. There were cheers from the onlookers. I wept tears of joy. Krishna had saved our home, but was also safe from harm. The relief. What would any of us do if we lost Krishna? So, you see, Mother, it was out of concern for my very best friend I was unable to come home. I've never seen a more amazing sight than Krishna's serpent dance. I hope you will forgive me, Mother. And I will tell this story over and over again forevermore.
Wow. That was the best one yet. Wow. Really powerful, you know, and wow, it's really powerful. It communicates, you know, I'm explaining, right? There's the core feelings of all the residents, like the mother, I'm your protector, and the friends. And then the gopis, right, looking at Krishna and saying, you know, remembering his smiles and saying, without you, my life is vacant. I have no feelings. And so they all have their sthaibhav, their feelings of love. And then there are the various actions in love. The father wanting to protect, the mother wanting to protect, you know, and then the sattvika bhavs, the involuntary thing, the tears, Mother Yasoda going to the, and then fainting in love because she's prevented. That's called sattvika bhav. And then all these emotions churning, the anxieties and the things. So look at that ocean of love. And by the story, then what is Krishna actually doing? He's in the coils of the serpent for 48 minutes. But what is he doing? He's enjoying the love of the devotees. The fatherly love has been churned to the greatest height. The motherly love by the Leela is that, you know, the friendship. You know, and the cow and the mothers, you know, they're in Vrindavan, and all of a sudden they see these different omens, and then they think, oh, what's happening to Krishna? And then they search for Krishna by going by the footprints, right? But what does the mother look when she's searching? Because Krishna's footprints are never erased in Vrindavan. So they know what they look like. So they're like yogis. Where are those footprints? And what is the mother saying? My son, my son, my son. And what are the friends saying? My friend, my friend, my friend. And what are the gopis saying? My lover, my lover, my lover. So all these different types of love. And by the Leela and the pastimes, all these five emotions are churning together to bring the motherly affection to the height of relish. And the friendship to the height of relish, and the conjugal love to the height of relish, and God is enjoying. He's the connoisseur of this perfect type of love. So this is the ultimate reality, and the dramas are communicating it so that we can actually feel it. So we're having another performance tomorrow in Jai Yoga in Park Slope. If anyone lives nearby, stop by. And also tomorrow, Giriraj. Anyway, we'll meet again in July, and I'll speak on some Krishna stories and show you how this is and the philosophical import that's being given them. Maybe I'll pick the story, The Wives of the Brahmins Delivered. Wow, what a story that is. Okay, so what a wonderful class we had. We all shared together so nicely. Different feelings ourselves of bhakti, you know, and it's a big thing, you know, and many of you made at least, you know, a lot of people made even, you know, 75% of the classes, which is impossible. Friends getting married and, you know, commitments and relatives coming in. So let's try to continue it every month. Those of you that are free, mark it on your calendar. And we'll meet together and we'll discuss more. Okay? Hey, well.